Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, hello, hello, leavers and believers. Welcome back to Leaving Hillsong. My name's Tanya and I'm thrilled that you've joined us for this conversation. Today is kind of a tough one, so you're going to need 2 cups of coffee and, as Nicolas Cage said, in Wild at Heart, this is probably a 2-cigarette problem. So smoke them if you got them, people, because content warning doesn't really begin to describe this. Today we're joined by Nick Jordan, and Nick is a journalist from the UK with 20 years experience in journalism, and he's now freelancing and researching for a company called The Voice of a Survivor, and they work with childhood sexual assault survivors who've experienced that assault in Australian institutions. From 2014 to 2017, we had a royal commission in this country into how institutions responded to reports of child sexual assault. And those institutions included churches and sporting groups and girls' homes, boys' homes, that kind of thing. Nick is kind of our Robert Ferguson. And for those who don't know, Robert Ferguson is an English guy who has been a teaching pastor at Hillsong for 30 years and really helped shape the culture. And he has a degree in biology, but he is a theologian, apparently. He's got this English accent that people really trust. And when you listen to Nick, you'll understand. I mean, I just believe everything he says with that sort of almost Jeremy Irons kind of thing he's got going. And he is a Catholic. And back in my day, we knew they're all going to hell because they're idol worshippers, but things have changed. And, you know, Brian realized that Catholic money was still money. And so we're all kind of okay with Catholics these days. This episode, In the Face of Something Awful, is about what to do when you have heard about child sexual assault, historical, current, if you have concerns, what can someone do next? So I think this is most important to listen to, get informed, get an understanding of what your options are, and the very real imperative we all have to keep children safe. So I'm thrilled to present this chat with Nick Jordan. That's been coming for a really long time. We've had a few delays. It's been on my mind since all of the kind of horrible crimes started coming out when Brian stepped aside. There was just report after report of sexual assault, and we got to do something. And while some of these reports related to adults, a lot of them also related to those underage. And so here's Nick Jordan telling us what we can do in the face of something awful. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Tanya.
How are you going?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, 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 good. Thank you so much for joining us here on Leaving Hillsong. You know, it started out a few months ago because of your work wanting to find out more about what people can do. We first started talking about this in March when all the stuff happened with Hillsong and Brian really stepped aside, and a lot of stories were coming out, just really horrible stories, things that people had been through. And it was ranging from, you know, being overworked to, you know, verbal abuse to really serious sexual abuse allegations. And that's where you and I started talking about this. And then you got COVID and then I got COVID. And So thanks for all your patience.
No, that's fine. And thanks for putting up with my absences as well.
You're working for a place called The Voice of a Survivor in Queensland.
Yeah, that's right. So I work as a freelance researcher and writer for a company called The Voice of a Survivor, who operate in Australia or across Australia. What we do is we represent adult victims of childhood sexual abuse in Australian institutions, which is a bit of a mouthful. Sort of. What we're normally doing is we're not lawyers or anything like that, but a survivor of sexual abuse in an institution will approach us, and we'll sort of guide them through the legal process and the pastoral process that they need to get two things usually, which is first a letter of acknowledgement and hopefully apology from the institution concerned where the client was abused, and two, financial recompense, you know, that the law allows for. So that's what I do, and I research and write. I interview survivors. I do this for a number of different clients, as well as The Voice of a Survivor, but they're the most prominent group of its type in the country. Been very successful, and when I say successful, I think we measure success by, you know, the amount of people, the survivors that we've encouraged to come forward and talk about what happened to them.
Okay. Now, just to clear that up with you, is it only sexual abuse that is covered under this? Because is this directly related to the Royal Commission is what I'm asking?
It is, yeah. I mean, it is large. I mean, we, you know, I mean, as you know already, I'm sure, sexual abuse cases fall under personal injury law as a general. So there is a sense of it being a personal injury thing, but because of the sort of background of the company and who it was founded by, a guy called Russell Mouncer, we've tended to focus on institutional sexual abuse. Yeah, that's right. And it does come off the back of the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse to 2013 and 2017 was a Royal Commission set to inquire about those things in Australian life, and it made a big impact. And it's the waves of that inquiry are still reaching Australia now, and we, you know, we're very much at the forefront of that. Yeah.
After the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses into Child Sexual Abuse, a big name in itself, the inquiry wanted to know how institutions responded when people reported.
Yeah.
After that, a lot of businesses cropped up, a lot of lawyers, a lot of websites, a lot of We Can Help You. How do people make the choice of who to contact, who to trust, who's going to do the actual right thing?
Well, I mean, good question. I mean, I think that the answer to that is almost in the question itself, is that, I mean, you're right. I mean, you're going to get a lot of personal injury lawyers, and we tend to associate that industry with what, you know, might call it ambulance chasing or whatever, where you've had a sort of worker's injury and, you know, a lawyer phones you. It's not like that. You know, the company, we're not allowed to operate like that in this sphere. That's there are laws about that. But two, we're not lawyers, so we're not a legal company. And because I think it's the provenance of the firm is what's important here, is that it was founded by Russell Mouncer, who's an extraordinary Australian, and he suffered institutional sexual abuse from the age of I think he was 13 at the Darrick Boys Home in Western Sydney, which is a notorious and long since closed establishment, and then also at Long Bay Prison, where he was incarcerated in an adult prison as a child and also sexually abused. But he went on to spend, you know, 23 years in jail on and off, robbing banks, heroin addicts, this kind of thing. And before having a kind of a, you know, epiphany, I suppose, at the Royal Commission, where he told his story for the first time and was believed, obviously. And he said it was the letter of apology and acknowledgement and the belief that the commission had in him that was life-changing, not the compensation. It's on the back of that we do all our work, you know, so yeah.
Yeah, because we were talking just before we started recording, about it's been my experience that it's, without discounting or minimising anything to do with abuse that people have gone through, it seems to be, you know, when they tell somebody, you know, it's the parent that doesn't believe them, or that really kind of has this devastating impact, and it seems to be the church's response that makes people lose their faith, not necessarily the abuse they went
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. And I think that that's where the danger really lies in terms of people, you know, keeping their faith, but also in terms of getting, most importantly, of getting the help and the safety that they need immediately. You know, already they're facing the most devastating experience of that any human being can face, in my view, which is being assaulted as a child for sexual reasons. And then to that, you know, very few people are able, for all sorts of very good reasons, in fact, to then go forward and say anything at the time. You know, they're just not able. They're terrified. They're not in the right circumstances. They're not in the right mind. It's just not possible. But those that do are able to are then find themselves in a situation where they're not, as you said, not believed, where they're ridiculed, where they're abused again, even. And that for me is a betrayal that is next level, because that's hard to understand. And I think at that moment, if you sexually abused by the parish priest, and you have the courage in you to go to the local archbishop or bishop, for instance, and I have heard many of these stories, and the bishop turns around and just says, you're an evil person for telling me this story, you know, and I don't want to hear this anymore. You go back and don't ever spread false rumors about priest again. At that moment, your trust in authority is broken forever, I think. You know, it never comes back, really. And I think that's where the church has suffered. You know, there was a moment, really, where the church could have said, you know, the Catholic Church I'm talking to, could have said, yes, we've known about it, and we're trying to do the right thing, instead of extending cover-up after cover-up after cover-up and calling them the Melbourne response or various redress schemes that they've launched. Mm-hmm. Are, for me, all part of a cover-up. There was a moment where they could have said, yes, we believe you now. But they've never really said that, you know. And I think that's the moment where...
Just to set for me, the Melbourne response is part of the cover-up? What do you mean by that? First of all, tell us what the Melbourne response...
The Melbourne response was a sort of project organised in response to widespread allegations of clerical sexual abuse by the Catholic Church in Australia. And the Melbourne response was launched by Cardinal George Pell, who was the most senior Catholic cleric in Australia. Mm-hmm. Who had been the Archbishop of Melbourne and of Sydney and various things. And the Melbourne response came early. It was the first organised Vatican response to these global scale allegations, you know. And Pell was widely hailed for it because it seemed to do the right thing. They offered a redress scheme, which is a one-off payment of not an insignificant amount of money to victims. It offered a kind of reconciliation model and things like that. And it struck people as the right thing to do. The Vatican at that point was still in kind of a state of shock and didn't do much that was positive. You know, the Melbourne response seemed proactive. It seemed open-minded. It seemed apologetic and that kind of stuff. What happened in the Royal Commission, however, is that some years later, after the Melbourne response was launched, is that it came under quite a lot of criticism by the Royal Commission into institutional responses. And I mean, what they found was really what people were going for is that survivors were being sort of introduced to the Melbourne response options. And that would include a redress scheme of, say, being paid, I don't know, an amount of money, say $70,000 for what the abuse they'd suffered. And we're talking about entirely ruined lives here. It's not just a moment of abuse in history. It's an entire life that has been affected by this. Yeah. So they're given a flat one-off payment that then precludes you from going back to law to get any more. That's part of the deal. Okay. You can't then sue again. And it's a very small amount, because common law lawyers then got involved and said, hang on a second, this is serious personal injury of the most, you know, grave level. This person is worth, you know, the injuries that have happened to them are considerably more grave. And so, you know, and then there was other aspects of the Melbourne response which started to look like asking people not to talk further. Do you know what I mean? To come forward, have your moment of reconciliation. Yep. You forgive us, we forgive you. Don't say another word. Thanks very much. Here's your 50 grand and walk out the door. You know, to me, it starts to look, when you bear in mind that George Pell was the Pope's, as a cardinal, he was, you know, he would have a speciality and be the Pope's right-hand man in a particular field. And George Pell was the financial advisor to the Vatican. So he had the Pope's ear on matters of finance. He was the key financial advisor to the Vatican. And the redress scheme of the Melbourne response starts to look like a money-saving scheme when you consider the real amounts that common law commercial lawyers could get for you in a common civil action. It's not a numbers game. And the calculus of abuse and damages is a hard calculation to make. You know, it's not an easy thing to make, but it's properly made by doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, and legal teams working together and a judge to work out exactly how much, you know, giving you money in return for something that is, you can't put a price on the damage that's been done to an individual and to society by an instance of child sexual abuse. However, someone will, because that's the way we work. You know, yeah. Someone will do that for you, and it'll be done properly and sensitively and with insight. And that will be a much larger amount than what you're offered by any redress scheme, you know. And so if someone senior in the Catholic Church had run the numbers quickly and figured, you know, if we just pay as many redress schemes as possible, you know, and avoid civil actions, we're going to save an awful lot of money over the next 10 years, because they knew full well the scale of the abuse going on in the Catholic Church. I start to doubt things like that, you know. And then, you know, I can't say anything more. I don't want to say anything more about George Pell's own situation, because, you know, he's who he is. Well, that would be my criticism. That's the criticism of the Royal Commission, which stands today as a written verdict, you know, on his behaviour. So
what do we make of the redress scheme that was introduced after our own Royal Commission, where various institutions signed up and people then approached them for compensation? I mean, was that a wholesale kind of way for minimising?
No, I would say not. I mean, I would say that anything that came out of the Royal Commission, you know, in that sense is a good thing. You know, we are backed the Commission 100%. So if the Commission had backed a redress scheme and they did something, then I think that's okay, because it comes from a different agenda. It comes from a entirely different place, you know. What the Melbourne response? The Melbourne response is a is an attempt to kind of keep the church together. In some ways, I don't blame the architects of it for doing that. That's their job, after all. The archbishops and cardinals of the Catholic Church are there to maintain its structures, not at all costs, however. Okay. But I would say I understand why they did that in some ways. That's not why the commission introduced a redress scheme. You know, that's.
We just keep going back to that idea of, you know, how do people know who to trust, particularly people who've had trust betrayed many times before? You know, how do you make those kinds of decisions? And, I mean, you're a person of faith yourself, are you not?
I'm a Catholic. I'm a Roman Catholic, yeah.
And, I mean, you're what we would think of as practicing in some form, aren't you?
I guess so. Yeah, sure. I don't think I'd get on very well with the current Vatican line and a lot of things, but, you know, that's their problem.
Okay, so how do you then reconcile, how do you reconcile actively reporting against leaders within that church, which, you know, is, and I'll tell you why, because there's this very strong loyalty culture that is taught to people who go to Hillsong, and they must defer to leaders and trust leaders, and this whole thing of touch not the Lord's anointed. You know, you don't criticize them, you don't speak against them. And then very much this, up until recently, and the Royal Commission, keep it in-house. You don't take it either to court.
You just described the Catholic Church's response as well, you know, I mean, but on an even bigger scale. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's the same. It's the same thing. That sort of Hillsong have used the same tactics and strategies. I would suggest that they are tactics and strategies.
How do people overcome what we've all been taught so strongly, so deeply, that you don't go around doing that? I mean, and that's your job now. Like, how does that work for you?
Well, you know, I don't find a conflict in it, because I think that it's a Catholic church, and the word Catholic, as in all embracing and global, it covers a lot of different approaches. You know, I suppose I would probably more find myself, there's a theology within Catholicism called liberation theology, which is not approved of by the Vatican particularly, and liberation theology priests find themselves being excommunicated and all sorts of things. But I would probably more land up in that camp of a sort of ground up movement of based in working for people who are in need, not abusing them, obviously, more sort of closely worded around Christ's teachings, I suppose, if you want to put it like that, and less dependent on the Vatican, what the Vatican says are in the rule. And that incurs the wrath of the Vatican every few years or so, and they get annoyed. But you won't find many, you know, liberation theologist movements involved in the child abuse scandal. I can tell you that for nothing. And that is one of the reasons why I think that the current Pope, Pope Francis, was made Pope, in fact. You know, he was, I believe, introduced to that role because Pope Benedict had to resign because of the scandal and his failure to sort of manage aspects of it. And that's a big thing, right? You know, popes don't just resign. So they introduced a cleric, a prelate, who they knew was clean in that regard. No one's ever suggested that Pope Francis has been involved in cover-ups or abuse or any type whatsoever. And he's a Jesuit, and they are the liberal lefties, if you like, of the Catholic Church, and they would more closely connect with the liberation theology I just mentioned.
Okay, so they're not involved in the scandals because...
why are they not involved in scams? I mean, I can't say 100%. I mean, certainly Jesuit priests and colleges have certainly been involved in the scandal. Let me just say that right off the bat. But I would say that they come from a sort of a ground up perspective where it's not of an authority bearing down on you and ordering you what to do. It's coming from the people, and that emanates from a genuine desire to help the people that you can say emulates Christ's example, if you wish, or just a genuine soup kitchen, a street worker type of example, you know, where people want to help. And that kind of thing, you can't buy that, you know, you can't replace it or you can't teach it. I think it's, you know, it's it's a sort of an internal rebellion of sorts. Mm-hmm. It's a reaction against the authority of the Vatican. It's a reaction against the child abuse cover-up. It's a requirement for honesty, a requirement for the people, you know.
Part of your work involves kind of tracing where some of these offenders are, doesn't it? I mean,
Yeah, we were looking into cases of historical child abuse in I can't really say the place, I suppose, but it's regional Australia in the 1990s, which is kind of like the epicentre of the high tide mark of the cover-up scandal before it was widely revealed to the public by the Boston Globe in their Spotlight articles, which I think were launched in 2001, were first published. So this case, particular case I was looking at, was back in the 90s, and the requirement from the lawyer was simply to find precedent examples of cover-ups in that diocese. And once you start digging, you find them, you know. And you know, I think that's the horror of any institutional cover-up, is you can't get away anymore with the one bad apple theory. You know, you suddenly start to look at it and you think, oh, it's not just one priest or two priests. It's actually everyone, you know, to some extent.
I seem to remember that the number given in Spotlight was that 94% of priests weren't offenders. So they're talking about
six. That's right, yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, and I mean that probably reflects a trend in society that, you know, it's statistically small, the number of people who'd be prepared to, you know, sexually exploit or abuse a child, right? But nonetheless, it's, you know, it's determinedly present, and more concerning of me as given what we're talking about, is the percentage of people prepared to play along with some kind of cover up in some capacity or other. So most people wouldn't do this. Agreed. However, a higher percentage than six percent would be prepared and have been involved in cover-ups, you know. And what does involvement in a cover-up mean? I mean, you can either be the bishop at the forefront, orchestrating the whole thing, from buying the plane tickets to get the priest out of the country, covering his address, all that kind of stuff, or you can be the secretary who overhears it and pretends that she didn't hear it, you know, or turns away and that kind of stuff. Or the, you know, the senior member of the parish who just lets it go. Rumours that the priest is a bit like that, doesn't ever mention it to anyone. Yep. You know, I mean, that kind of stuff, you know. That's the culture we need to change.
And I think that, you know, that's a very similar culture to the kind of stuff, I mean, that's going on in Hillsong. When stuff started happening in March, there were just so many stories coming out. Mm. So what does the secretary do? I mean, and that's what I wanted to just demystify some of that process. What would the secretary that overhears something do?
Yeah, and I think I just want to make that's a good question. I want to make a quick distinction there between the I don't want to put the secretary person, the overhearer, at the centre of the frame here. They're not the abuser, right? But I don't need to be clear about that.
No.
But they are, in some ways, they are part of the abused and also the abuse. You know, they're a victim as well in some ways. It depends how willingly they play along with it, you know. But I think there is, if you are suddenly just a kind of a bit player in a bigger picture that you're not aware of, and that you're suddenly exposed to, even fleetingly, that's going to be quite shocking. A moment of realisation where you think, you know, why did you buy those airline tickets for a South Pacific island to get Father O'Leary out of the country by 2 a.m. the next day? You have a moment of realization. It's not your fault. You know, I think we need to be clear on that. But, you know, I think there does come, you know, with the increasing awareness that we've had over the last 10 to 20 years of child abuse taking place in institutions, there has to come now a moment where you perhaps do need to stop and think about what you're doing, even if you've just done it, you've been caught up with it, you didn't realize.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well, you were scared. You didn't dare say anything. It's to go back and reflect, you know, in private on what's happened and perhaps think again about the next thing, because that is the person at the other end of that, you know, at the other end of the trail of deceit and cover up is a child. And they're facing a lifetime sanction that you're not, you know. So I think we're all well educated enough now. We can't excuse ourselves and say we didn't know what's going on. We know it's out there, you know. Yeah. We have to be more aware. We have to take care of each other.
Who do they then contact? The secretary? Do they call?
It's not easy, no. And we have lots of evidence. So if it's a respected institution, for instance, in a smaller town, you might not find help from the police either. You know, I just don't. You know, it just really depends on circumstance. My clear advice to anyone in such a circumstance, faced with what they believe is evidence of child sexual abuse in an institution, is to go to the police. It is your first point of call, because at the very least, it will be recorded. You know that you made a complaint.
I've always thought, even if people, I can't help it with social work always coming back, if people can't even face the police station or making a call to one of the helplines, even just to document it at home, to write what happened, when it happened, what you heard, and put it on a piece of paper and I don't know, or in a file or something, no one else needs to see it. And then you can decide, because it's incredible what you do forget, you know, guilty of that. Oh, no, I'll remember that in a month's time. But you
well,
never
exactly.
It, you know, no. That's fresh. And they start counting as legal documents.
Yes, they do. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you'd be surprised 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line, you never know who comes knocking on the door looking for that kind of information, you know. And it might be investigators from a Royal Commission, for instance. It might be the police the next week. It might be also the local journalists from the investigatory team of the local newspaper, whoever it is, they, to my mind, may be agents of the truth, you know. And it is worth, and as someone who researches these things and looks for scraps of evidence like that, I can tell you now that kind of thing is invaluable to future investigations.
Okay.
And it doesn't have to be a police investigation. It can simply be some arbiter of truth, you know, and that's what's needed more than anything.
You know, and it can be because of the level of coercion and manipulation that we are hearing about from people who are victims of abuse in Hillsong. There's often a lot of rewards attached, special treatment, gifts, all that kind of stuff. People are coerced into believing, you know, relationships are consensual, where they're clearly, you know, abusive. So
it's grooming. It's a form of grooming. And I mean, I think that's what people, when you say coercion to people, they, including myself, my default position is to assume some sort of hostile force that's been pushing you in a certain way. But coercion doesn't always work like that, as I know you and your listeners will know. Coercion can come with a smile, you know, come with a smile on its face and a present in its hand.
So it's taking people a lot of time to even kind of recognize that what took place wasn't right or wasn't fair. There's situations like that. You know, the average person, because once Brian Houston, it was like the head got kind of knocked off.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
This organization, and so many people felt freer to talk about all kinds of things. And then these crimes started coming out, and I just started thinking, what can people do who aren't trained in any particular legal law? So it's been interesting to hear that it's a personal injury laws as well.
It certainly falls under personal injury or professional standards liabilities might be something. I mean, I'm aware that the Catholic Church often find themselves being sued in these cases in the guise of a company called Catholic Church Insurance, who insure the Catholic Church in Australia, basically. And I believe they've had to pay quite a lot out. Personal injury and professional standards suits that they fight.
I found this thing this morning, Nick. I want to kind of show you what, I mean, I know you're familiar with misogyny in the Catholic Church, but
There's a pastor from the, you know, this group, his name's John McMartin, and he's facing charges. He was charged last year with, there's a website run by a man called Donald Ellie, who has been following very closely the Hillsong, anything that Brian does, anything, you know, Pat Mesenti does, all these people. He's quite prolific with his writing. And this is how he covers it, just to give you a bit of background about this culture.
Yeah.
Okay, so John McMartin was one of the high-up executives at the time of the various concerns about behaviours of concealment that were going on. John McMartin was part of that hot potato process of passing that information on. So he's got a bit of pressure anyway, but Pleasure Point writes, this man is where Pastor John came unstuck with one of his parishioners in 2013 at his home. He has a swimming pool. Was there a pool party on a hot summer's day? Now, then he quotes from the ABC that, according to court documents, police allege the 66-year-old put his hand down the girl's pants and squeezed her breasts at his Pleasure Point home in January 2013. After more than 30 years, he was forced to step down as a senior pastor of the Inspire Church at Hoxton Park, et cetera, et cetera. This woman was 18. Now, this former man who advertises himself as a lay preacher of some great standing says, it's going to be very hard to defend the charges in light of the Me Too movement and the greater willingness of courts to believe victims of sexual assaults. Hard to defend, but not impossible. There's bound to be a lot to it. I'm guessing consumption of alcohol, a hot summer Sydney day, scant bikinis, and lots of other background. A pool party, lots of silliness, laughter, flirting, and shenanigans. It'll all come out in court. There is the question of how much responsibility is on a female in a situation like this. Was the young lady leading Pastor John on? And if so, how much? If the allegations are true, Pastor John yielded to temptation and did something very foolish. If you compared Pastor John's wife, an old granny, to a young nubile thing, one can see Pastor John fell into a baited trap. Just shows older men have to be very careful. He then goes on, being a multimillionaire for many decades, he says, I'm always on the watch for a young woman targeting me for a big payout.
Good God. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So that's the culture that we're fighting here. Yeah. It's about sin. This has now been reconstructed as he's fallen for the temptress. What?
Yeah, of course. Of course. What? Yeah.
And that's that's 50 years between them. He's her pastor, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how it's immediately reframed. Disgusting.
Well, you said you've used the right word. They've reframed it, haven't they? And because it's the same old argument that it always was. It's the same old sexist and brutal.
Incredible.
The thing is, what I was going to say is that's all they've got. The reason it's the same argument reframed is because that is all they've got. And they know it. You know, all they've got is that same old sexist stereotype. They're going to pin it on the woman, call her a Jezebel, and that's
and
that.
That's not even McMartin's friend. That's just a commentator that left.
Yeah.
You know? You know, so that's what people who are thinking about reporting sexual abuse at Hillsong are up against.
They are, sadly. And I think there's no getting away from that hard reality. And I think what Hillsongers, ex-Hillsongers and Catholics alike will face is the surprisingly easy willingness of a lot of people to put the reputation of the institution before the needs of an abused individual.
And that's the holiness of the men or the fallibility of the male involved as a given.
Yes, I know.
You know, I can't see that as any less damaging than the Catholic Church's response. I'm sorry, I don't see that as any less brutal.
Yeah. It's a shame.
It's exactly the same stuff, and it's a very frightening patriarchal.
But it strikes me as well that Hillsong, you know, Hillsong had an opportunity to do it differently. You know, these things do happen within these institutions, and it may not always be the fault of the institution as such. It is the response, and that's what I've always gone back to, the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. Yeah. You know, and I think it's the response that's the key. And Hillsong had a chance to respond differently, and they didn't. And I find that beggars belief in my book, you know, because they saw what happened to the Catholic Church. And
yes,
and they're not stupid people. And yeah, here we are again, you know. So I don't know.
Okay, so just setting that aside for a minute, Nick, can you tell us a bit more about, you know, what people can do with information that they've gained? If we can just talk a bit more about that.
If it's a child abuse instance, that is, a time is of the essence. You know, absolutely any police officer would tell you when a child goes missing, for instance, or is abused, the time is of the essence. So,
and the historic, you know, cases?
You know, I would suggest you could go to the police, but not the emergency line, and they would refer you, I'm sure, at least in this day and age. You can go to, whatever your local helpline website is, if it's the Samaritans or people like that in Australia, it's Lifeline. They will have resources and numbers. You can go to the media. You can go to the press. And I think that's...
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, perhaps not the local town newspaper. That's may not be ideal. But if you go to the bigger local press, you know, like as we were saying earlier to ourselves, the media who broke the Catholic Church scandal to a global audience was a regional newspaper in the form of the Boston Globe. And, you know, they are hot for a story. And I'll tell you why any newspaper is, because that's news is a business and they're always looking for a headline and they're always looking for a story. Now, that sounds a bit cynical. However, if you present them with something, they will tend to run with it. They'll believe you and go with it. And that's what you need at that moment. You need someone to believe you. It doesn't turn you away. It doesn't give you bureaucratic fob-offs, but who listens and takes notes and pays attention and marks the date and the time and that kind of stuff. All that stuff can be important later. So go to a journal, you know, go to the press. They'll listen, you know.
They can apply pressure sometimes as well. I just am thinking about now, you know, people having to tell their story multiple times to find that person that's going to, you know, do the job properly. And again, who to trust and how to choose is such a big part of
it. It is. I mean, I think if you're struggling, I mean, if you do find, you know, you've sort of done a couple of the things we've suggested here and then you still find that you're not getting anywhere, it's to find activists. It's not that difficult to find activist groups on the, you know, and people like yourself, Tanya, and they will help you. There are groups out there who will help you. Go to Facebook, go to open internet search and you'll find activists and whatever. They will have numbers, ideas, and they will act proactively, almost 100% definitely. And they'll get something done for you.
The beauty of documentation is that you've then got all your stuff written down for when you do need to tell that story again. You know, you don't have to kind of go back and remember again.
And here's the sad reality of that is if you do have to stand up and tell that story, because you will be contested. Someone will stand up and say that you're not telling the truth in one way or another. They'll either say that you've got faulty memory, if they're being polite, or if they're really going for you, that you're a liar and you're out to get the church, and they will roast you in court. Their expensive lawyers will try and have a go, possibly. Yeah. So be prepared, you know, have that stuff ready, you know, and your lawyers will thank you for it. And I can tell you now, the survivors will thank you too.
Yeah, terrific. I think that's all really good. Like, just for people to know that there's various options and, you know, they don't have to race in like a, you know, a major drama strap. Obviously, if a child is in immediate danger, you'd go.
Of course. Absolutely.
Looking at some of the crimes that have taken place in these mega churches in places like Hillsong and that have, as I said, you've been like reframed so often as sin, often for both parties. That situation was, you know, a man who fell into temptation, so they're both at fault. And when people start reflecting and realizing that it's a crime, not a sin, it could be earth-shattering. And I believe if it went through these churches worldwide, it had set the place on fire, and I don't know what would be left standing. It's amazing to watch the more people telling stories, sharing information. These aren't isolated incidents.
No, they're not.
They're through the place.
That's right. And I think also institutions like Hillsong and the Catholic Church, having seen precedent examples, say take Hillsong, they've seen the precedent example of the Catholic Church and they've chosen to do more or less the same thing. That, to me, beggars belief, just in terms of strategic thinking. But anyway, but nonetheless, they use things like they're aware of your faith and fear, of faith and fear of authority, for instance, so that they're aware that most people don't really want to get the police involved in their lives. You know, it's not a good look. It's all sorts of reasons. They're aware of that hesitation that most people have. Most people don't want to call the police. Of course, it's a bad thing normally that the police turn up because there's a problem, right? Yeah. And so I think they rely on that civic hesitation that people have to do the right, they want to do the right thing, but actually by not progressing, they're kind of doing the wrong thing. And I think there's a sort of a sort of subconscious coercion that goes on as well. You know, the people like Hillsong, the people orchestrating these kind of cover-ups are keen on and they're aware of in the way that perhaps we're all not. And, you know, ultimately, I think if you do have a problem, I understand for lots of reasons why people might want to not phone police services. But, you know, if we're talking about child sexual abuse here, it's what we're talking about. That is also a health issue. That's a health and safety issue. Call an ambulance because the police will have to attend anyway. Okay. And if you really can't bring yourself to speak to a police officer, and because I work with a lot of people who can't deal with police services, you know, they just cannot trust the police anymore, is you can probably trust a paramedic, right? They can probably make that leap. And it is, after all, a health and safety issue. You know, if someone is being, you suspect of being abused, then, if you want to boil it down, that's what's happening.
Okay, so, and you're not talking about finding, like, running in on an actual episode. You're talking about a general awareness you can call an ambulance.
Well, I think, you don't want to waste ambulance services time here, but, yeah. I mean, I think if you think that something's going on, absolutely, and you're reluctant to call the police because you don't think you'll be believed or they'll turn up with the wrong attitude or whatever, then, you know, you have a situation that you could viably describe as a health and safety, a health emergency, I think. So, you know, just get someone involved is the thing. Yeah, you can't deal with this on your own. You cannot deal with it on your own. That's the one thing I know for sure, you know.
And I mean, the guys that you work with are, I mean, these are people with long criminal histories, right? Like some serious
disorders
there. And they're working alongside the authorities now. I mean, is that?
Well, yeah, we kind of, yeah, well, yeah. I mean,
so, I mean if sense, they I mean, can do it.
Yes, well, absolutely. That's what I'm sure they would say too. Yeah, I mean, a guy who founded the company, as I said, has spent 23 years in and out of jail, and you know, you develop a certain relationship, I suppose, with the forces of law and authority over that course. But you know, there comes a point where the police need to be involved. You know, there does, and we, you know, we have to work with prisons. You know, we are critical in some ways, I suppose, of the corrective system and the way it works. But we have to work with the prison. You know, we want the best for our clients. Prisons are usually amenable, more or less. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's just the contract that, you know, that we have with society, wider society. But it's not always ideal. But, I mean, the basic reality of our situation and the clients we deal with is that the majority of them are in prison. And the reason they're in prison is because of the things that happened to them when they were children, you know. And there is a clear link between those things. None of it excuses whatever they did later. You know, we're not trying to support or excuse criminal lifestyles or drug taking or anything like that, but there are reasons why people behave the way they do, you know. And I don't know what the actual percentage is, but I spend most of my day talking to people who have been who either are in prison at that moment or have significant prison, so, you know, incarceration histories, and usually attended by drug addiction or alcohol abuse, by, you know, inability to form relationships with, you know, romantic and loving relationships, tendencies to violence and outbursts of anger management. Most of our clients are male as well. And so it's, you know, yeah, all that kind of stuff seems a huge taboo subject, but that's where we work. And that's, you know, the crucible of where we go, really.
It's deep in the Australian culture. You know, we were started as a giant outdoor prison, and that mentality really does carry across till today, you know, especially amongst criminals, such as some people that you're working with are, you know, have had a long career in crime, you know, glamorous or not. So, you know, it is something that people here are very resistant to, as some kind of betrayal of a code or a social code to go and report to police. But I believe that, well, along with that, it's a different thing. It's not a snitchy thing. It's not a betrayal thing. It's not a...
No. You know, well, that's it. I mean, that's what we say. I mean, that's a big thing for us as well, for the voice of a survivor, is that we would say that you're not snitching or dobbing anyone in if they've committed a sexual abuse, a sexual crime against a child. That's not a dob or a snitch. That needs to be stopped. They're right there and then, you know, and I think that whole attitude and culture needs to change. That emanates from my own personal views, but also from the company I work for. They're on the prisoner's side. They're not advocating snitching, but what they're saying is it's different if it's a child at stake. And it affects all of us, you know, because, you know, one abused child may go on to radiate harm and damage through society in their own anger, and they're lashing out. You know, just the economic damage that does to society is impossible to calculate, but will be high And so we're doing society a favour, actually, by, you know, helping that child to somehow stop, or for the child to get help earlier on in life, or whatever it is.
Yes.
You know, so it's a wider help we're asking for. So, and, you know, if your instincts turn out to be wrong, better to err on the side of caution. You know, don't pursue vendettas against people who actually aren't paedophiles or whatever. But I would say that if your instinct is telling you there's a problem, try and report it, please, and then that the law will sort that out. You have to have some faith in authority at some
point. And that's, you know, I mean, that's again the beauty of a diary and stuff is, you know, if you kind of record events and conversations and that
absolutely
patterns start to emerge.
We cannot stop people wanting to hurt children in society, unfortunately. We cannot stop it. There will always be those people present. For whatever their reason, be they opportunistic or psychiatric or criminally motivated, whatever it is, they are around. Nonetheless, what we can do is we can all of us play an active part in stopping the cover-up, not being a part of it, seeing it if it happens, and being not just dutiful citizens, but just good to one another, you know. I think that's what it boils down to, and I think we all are essentially. That's what we want to do, and then, you know, I think it's not such a hard thing to ask. And I would also just add, you know, I just talked about the cover up as if it's an organized conspiracy. It isn't, and that's what frightens me most of all. It's just people not knowing how to behave in the face of something awful, you know, which is understandable. And just refer back to your common decency, the love you have for your own children, and that kind of thing. You'll need to tell the truth, and I think it will guide you through.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, fantastic. Well, I want to pull apart the pyramid of abuse stuff. There's people that actively prop up an offender or a perpetrator of something, and there's people that do it, you know, by default or through ignorance. Mm. All kinds of ways that happens. That's fantastic. Mm. Jordan, thank you so much for your time today.
Appreciate you. You're welcome. It's lovely to talk to you.
Please keep this good work up and look after yourself in this, would you?
Thank you, I will, and you too, Tanya. Thanks for inviting me on.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye.
Hey, everyone, and thank you so much for sticking around for this episode of Leaving Hillsong. I think you'll agree that was pretty urgent and important for as many people to hear as possible. You can find Nick at nickjordanmedia.com. And, of course, please share. I'm sure you can think of a whole bunch of people that could really use this information on a number of levels. Thanks so much to Nick. Thanks so much to all of you. Thank you for all your support. And a huge shout out to my Patreon supporters. Love ya. It's going to be a pretty heavy few months coming up. So stick around. Keep supporting. Keep liking. Keep sharing. We'll be back next week. Keep being kind to each other. Keep looking after each other, and please keep being kind to yourselves. Leaving Hillsong is hard, but keep leaving Hillsong, and we'll talk soon. Bye.
Softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.